and gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. Come on by, check us out, maybe become a paid member of the community so that we can do all the good things. And today we are going back to the well. We're going to keep trying this until it actually works. in the spirit of the beatings will continue until morale improves. We're going to do another one of these drive time things. I know some people don't like them. Some people really like them. There seems to be an age difference in the people who like them versus don't like them. In terms of the feedback that I've gotten. So
what's the, who likes us and who doesn't?
Okay. So young people seem to like the millennial badinage nice. More than people my age who understandably think all you people should be put in labor camps. But
that is to be expected, I guess.
So just so listeners know what we're doing here, that was Ryan Brown from The Dispatch. We also have Nick Pompella, my ambassador in Indiana at this point. Say hello, Nick.
I've been in many meetings with Lord Mitch on your behalf. So
excellent. He's my banner man in the West. and then in the way east, I suppose, right? I mean, is it east of here? It should be, yes. We have Guy Denton, which interestingly translated from the original Norman means "oh piss boy."
That's a new one, Joe.
That was like a compliment. He put some effort into that one.
He gave it some thought.
And another piece of the feedback is that that I've gotten from people, at least the feedback I've found persuasive. Some of the feedback I find unpersuasive, and you live in public essentially for 20 plus years, you learn to sometimes reject feedback from people that you don't think is persuasive. But some people have accused you people, you three, of being too deferential, nigh upon sycophantic to me, and that you are my Greek chorus and laugh track and little more. And so this is one of the reasons why last night I asked you guys to come paired with some things that you wanted to talk about. And I'll just say that, you know, one reason why I keep wanting to make this thing work is, again, we want to up the volume of the number of remnants over the course of time. And two, there's this growing divide within the Dispatch between sort of like Steve's side and my side. And I want my side to be like the fun side. the wacky side, the you never know what's going to happen side. I mean, like Steve, they have these little lunches with the young reporters.
I was going to say, Steve buys us food.
Yeah, I know. teaches you how to write a nut graph and call and talk to a source. Look, Ryan, we got booze delivered to us. I mean, where are your priorities,
that's
dude?
That is true. See, I somehow have threaded the needle perfectly to where I get the free lunches and the booze.
Exactly.
Somehow.
You're right.
I'm right smack dab in the middle. I'll take it.
The penance for that is that you also, only saw the video yesterday, also have to eat bugs, which is not
this
a good trade-off.
This is true.
Yeah, so I know you talked about it at AO, that niche podcast that we put out, but I have not heard you at least publicly make your give us your reviews. Yeah, so why did it happen?
Right.
What was it like? Do you regret it? Were there any postprandial consequences that you will have to speak euphemistically about that make you regret it? All of these things I would like to know.
So look, we're all dealing with COVID in different ways. No, so this was actually Alec Dent's idea, who was head fact checker at the Dispatch.
Former intern of mine.
Oh, yeah, really? Okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea was very dispatching. He was like, everyone's saying we should eat more bugs, but no one's actually eating them. And so he said, all right, I'm going to eat them. And we talked about it on our staff meeting, and everyone was like, no, don't do that. And I was kind of like, that sounds interesting. And so I joined him. I did very little work, to be honest. He did all the research. He found the recipes, for lack of a better term, on how to cook the cicadas. I just showed up with a bottle of wine, and we chowed down at his apartment.
Did he cook them all one way? I mean, what was the preparation?
So he went out. I thought this was the funniest part. I was in a different part of town, trying to find cicadas, and I couldn't find any because there just wasn't a lot of greenery. It was newly developed, so there just wasn't a lot of cicadas. And I texted him.
A sure sign they're a young person living amidst urban blight if you yes, don't have any cicadas right. around you. In
exactly,
DC.
Yeah. And I said, I can't find any cicadas. I'm really sorry. And he was like, it's okay. I think we'll be okay. I found 30. And I said, yeah, I think 30 will be plenty. I don't know how many you're planning on eating, but I don't plan on eating at least 15 if we're going to split this. So he had plenty of cicadas. This was also hilarious. I went over and I saw him tossing cicadas in olive oil, salt, and pepper, which was just a hilarious sight to see a man just literally in his kitchen preparing food. He really leaned into the bit. So there was like some fun, like cafe music playing in the background. Exactly. Yeah. And he's tossing cicadas. And I was like, wow, this is happening, huh? And so what he did is he boiled them to sanitize them, tossed them in olive oil, salt, and pepper.
So you take the wings off, right? They are not winged creatures.
No, I don't think so. No, I think the wings are on, but you have to wait until they molt, which means they shed their old skin.
Okay.
I think that's how it works. We'll put the article in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's so you can eat them. That's to where it's like, that's to where it's edible and it's not going to hurt you.
Or scratch your throat on the way down.
Yeah, exactly. He made I can barely say this word, but a charcuterie board.
Charcuterie. Yeah.
Charcuterie. That's it.
Yeah.
We found your compass, Ryan.
There. Yeah. I know. It's the worst. Yeah, that is it. But anyway, he made one of those boards, and it was beautifully prepared. There were all sorts of cheeses, and he had olives and a fancy
but for the giant bugs on it.
And I walked in, and I'm like, oh, this is nice. This is a nice little appetizer. Oh my God, there's bugs on that also. It was pretty striking.
It's sort of like that scene in The Jerk, which I just wrote about the other day, about Steve Martin gets served the snails, and he starts screaming at the maitre d', there's snails on her plate!
Exactly. Except this he would have had a good case to be upset at the restaurant for having cicadas on the plate. And then we had it with crackers and cheese, and we couldn't really taste the cicada. Mm-hmm. And so we went back to the well and just had a straight cicada. Mm-hmm. And I'll say this, it was beautifully prepared. Alex's initial thought and what he said in the video was it kind of tastes like popcorn. And I couldn't disagree with him. Like it was just, I read in one of the comments on the Dispatch website, someone said, this just proves if you put anything in olive oil, salt, and pepper, it's going to be okay at least. That was kind of the best explanation. Final thoughts, if you're lacking protein or minerals or something, there are better ways to get that. We don't need to be eating bugs. But I'm glad I did it. It was kind of fun.
And so that was the only preparation. I thought he made pasta too.
Oh, well then, yeah. So then there was the second course. Yeah.
Other than that.
Forgot about that. That was also pretty much just inspired by the meeting where someone, I think David said, what are you going to put them on, fettuccine Alfredo? Half jokingly. And then Alec made fettuccine Alfredo. He also homemade the sauce. It was really good Alfredo. And then we just.
But for the bugs in it.
But for the possible butt fungus from the cicadas.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite the experience.
And no gastrointestinal distress or
No, I was feeling horrible the next day, but I would imagine that was because I was at an Irish pub with live music for the first time in about a year and a half that night. So
yeah.
I can't blame the cicadas for my horrible
Just your physical day. Presence there would make you ill, right? It had nothing to do with anything you had personal agency over.
Right, exactly. I couldn't help it. It was just, it's in my blood.
Sure.
No, so the cicadas, and now I'm seeing a bunch of people now eating cicadas. I feel like we kind of kicked off a movement here. I'm seeing it more on Twitter, like people are actually eating them.
Yeah.
And then in true Steve Hayes fashion, we couldn't put in the title of the article that we had eaten cicadas.
Right. So it's like some boring, like summer cuisine trends kind of.
Yeah, thing? I thought it was kind of funny. I think they ended up on, something like these. Here are some fun summer recipes.
You got that for you, right? So like you can now say you've done it. It's like a Super Bowl ring. Yep. They can't take it away from you.
Yep.
Right.
And
in 17 years when they come back. And everyone's like, should I eat him? I'd be like, no, don't.
You can get really like, you can go to an Irish pub and on your way out, you can go to the cicadas and just scream at them, I ate your grandparents.
exactly. Yes.
Your parents, right? I mean, it's not like there's generations.
Yeah.
So these bugs that come out of the ground, they're 17 years old, right? I never really focused on that. That's an old bug when you think about it. Most bugs don't live that long, I would think. I think I'm on safe entomological territory here when I say that most bugs don't live 17 years.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Then they come up and then they live for 6 weeks and then die. Like that's it. That's their whole life.
Well, the thing is, so I tweeted this the other day and I got a lot of backlash about it. You know, I like thinking in these terms just before. So the tweet is, you know, so as I mentioned, as I wrote about it in the eulogy to my dad, every year at Thanksgiving, my dad had the driest sense of humor in the world. It was basically walk across a desert and eat a pack of saltines while doing it, kind of dry. and he would always turn to me at the end of Thanksgiving dinner, you know, when the turkey carcass is like, you know, we've ripped off the legs or his ribs and or not ribs, but you know, it's just a husk, a bone that you could use for stock. And my dad would turn to me and say, Jonah, do you think if we got the world's greatest scientists and medical experts together, that there'd be any chance of saving this turkey's life? and the other thing he would say at every Thanksgiving was as he started to carve the turkey, he would mutter under his breath, you know, on a planet populated by super intelligent turkeys, this would be one of the most disgusting horror films they've ever seen. as he dug into the turkey. So anyway, I grew up with my dad saying stuff like this. I said this first to my wife the other day and she thought it was funny. So I tweeted it, that if you made a movie in an alternate universe where human beings where cicadas were human beings, it would be like a Hieronymus Bosch dark thing, right? They emerge from the subterranean Stygian depths to have sex amidst the corpses of their kin. And then they have days to live while they're slowly dying and being hunted by dinosaurs, right? I mean, it'd be terrifying. Yeah. And everyone's like, you shouldn't smoke pot in the middle of the day. I thought it was a good tweet.
So, good advice, though. Good advice from Twitter.
Oh, my God.
Speaking of people taking tweets too seriously. So yesterday was the news that, my friend Charlie Cook, Gold Jacket class remnant guest.
Right.
Confirmed or reported that he could confirm what Maggie Haberman had reported, which was that Trump actually does believe that he's going to be reinstated in August. And so I like tweeted, got to confess, a lot of us are going to have a lot of crow to eat if Trump is actually reinstated in August. And then I tweeted another one saying, I can't wait for the Supreme Court case of Trump v. United States where Rudy Giuliani argues it in front of the Supreme Court. And all these people are taking me seriously. I mean, there's like There's no way the court will accept that case.
Like, really?
Adding Pope hat? Like,
yeah, hire that guy, Jonah.
Can I get a ruling on that, David Frank? All right. Anyway.
Well, that's the way in which Twitter is the poorest replacement for a blog ever, right? It took over the blogging space and is much worse because I don't know why it's worse, but it seems like no one acclimates to the personalities of people on Twitter, so they don't know when people are joking because it's anonymous to people. I don't know what it is. It's a poor replacement for blogging, it seems, where there was more jocularity, it seems to me, at least. I mean, I read some very late blogs that survived, but I'm kind of too young. I mean, that's the true horror of this, Jonah, is that you said that the older listeners don't like the millennial badinage. Mm-hmm. The truth is, Ryan is the only one of us that I think you could actually classify as a millennial. I'm on the cusp.
That's true.
And Guy is younger than me, which means he is in Gen Z. Like, there's no
way. Yeah, look, I find all of these distinctions tedious. Like, my view is, I'm like, when you're exiting in a plane, everybody in front of you in the aisle is moving way too slow, right, and everybody behind you in the aisle is way too impatient. Right. Everybody younger than me, with the exception of some, like, maybe 30 and 40 somethings, are just you damn kids. And I don't distinguish amongst you. It's like, it's a crowd scene in a Godzilla movie. Oh, there's a Japanese guy, you know? But point taken. So, do you guys believe that Trump believes that, like, what is I'm not discounting or disputing Charlie Cook's reporting on this. I think he's a guy of immaculate integrity. And Steve has been telling me stuff that, you know, one of the reasons why he's bummed about the story is that he feels like he really is itching to get back to reporting because he knew some of these things and just been doing so much, you know, white bag and whatever he does. So white bag is a 1980s term for cocaine that just went right over all your heads.
Right.
So, but anyway, so I believe the reporting, but that doesn't mean one can't do some criminology about what's going on. Are people leaking it to create a backlash to get them to stop? I mean, what do you guys think is the objective truth of the matter?
I feel like that's probably right. I mean, I totally believe that he believes it because he's just crazy. But yeah, that's probably, they've probably tried to get him to come to his senses and realize that there's no way that can actually happen. And the only way to speak to him is through the media because he watches it all the time. So that is totally, I would buy that for sure. Absolutely.
Because Trump has been brought to his senses successfully so many times in the past.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's going to work.
Completely recanted what he said about Joe Scarborough being a psychopathic murderer and vaccines causing autism, all that wonderful stuff.
Right. Right.
So here's my only concern about this is, not my only concern. And look, part of my concern is that the dude's back wano crazy and he's deluded and he's sociopathically narcissistic. And you know, this is a guy, remember, he said under oath that his estimate of his own net worth changes with the mood that he's in.
Right. And, like an actual solipsist in the philosophical sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also I mean, I know I'm like the only person who's like really jazzed about my argument about romanticism in my book, but like this idea that your feelings create reality. I mean, Trump is that guy in spades.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't shock me at all that he's convinced himself of this. You know, he follows the George Costanza rule, which is if you believe it, it's not a lie. So he makes himself believe stuff. But I would prefer more people of Trump world went out on the limb and backed him on this to a certain extent, so that because right now what I would predict happens is Trump comes out. Well, It's entirely possible in front of the rally. He's giving a big speech to a rally this weekend, right, in North Carolina.
Yeah.
If he goes there, it's possible he just, you're damn right, I ordered the code red. I'm coming back in August, baby, right? So, because he can't resist audiences. So that's definitely possible. But what concerns me is that he'll come out and he'll say, fake news. This is not true. I've never said anything like it. And the usual Trump Praetorians will come out and say, see, this is another example of how the media always lies. Yeah. It wasn't true, as if like Trump's denial is dispositive, you know, like, oh, well, Trump says it's not true. It must not be true then. But
he was joking. He's used the joking excuse many times.
Right. I mean, he said in the debate with Biden that the pouring disinfectant inside our bodies and using UV lights on our intestines thing was a joke. And that he was sarcastic. And he was,
which from any other politician would actually maybe be believable, but not...
Or if you hadn't seen the video, right? I mean, it's sort of like, it's like Michael Flynn's denial that he didn't call for a Burmese style coup.
Yeah.
I mean, it was funny. It's like, I originally wrote about that for the LA Times. And over the night, you know, we repurposed it as my first syndicated column. He denied it. He came out with a denial. And like normal journalistic practice is to say a claim he denies, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And I like, we sent out the column and then I went back to my editor and was like, you know, maybe we should have put it. And he was like, I mean, I hear you, but like, it's just plainly on video and, you know, and nobody. And the thing is, he also, Flynn also has this like long record of calling for martial law and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's not like inconsistent and it's how the audience read it. Like the idea that like he meant what he was saying was, there's no reason why we should have a military coup, as if he was rejecting the idea, right? Basically, if I was taking a comma out of it, if the audience thought that's what he was saying, they would have lynched him, right? Yeah. I mean, he clearly So anyway, I just worry that it's going to be another one of these things where people cling to Trump's denial as a way to turn it into another round of ass-scratching media criticism.
Passion. Yeah. You know?
Well, the most shocking thing about it to me is that it really seemed for a solid minute there that, and maybe this was just a construction of basically people taking inopportune photos, right? Which is one of the masterful things that you can do to manipulate a story is, you know, get a picture to accompany a headline of someone looking really evil or whatever. There were all of these pictures of Trump.
Homer sleeps nude in an oxygen tank.
Exactly. Precisely. But no, I mean, there were all of these pictures post-election of Trump looking really dejected. Mm-hmm. And he's golfing at Mar-a-Lago, but he's all sad looking and all of this stuff. And it really did seem for a minute there like, he just sort of, it was sort of like the weight of reality finally landed on his shoulders where it's like, oh my God, I'm a geriatric. I'm like, I hate to say, but you know, this is a factor that I assumed meant that he wouldn't be too serious about the Stop the Steal stuff, right? Is that he's old. And I know we're all, you know, we're three Americans and a spiritual American here in this conversation, but I know the logic of Americans more so than anywhere else in the world is that you kind of work until you die, and there's less of an emphasis on, you know, just stepping away from your work and retiring. But it just seemed absurd to me that someone of that age would want to return to that job after being given the opportunity to leave because it's a psychopathically difficult job to do. And I don't know why you would want to go back if you had the excuse to leave. But I guess he enjoyed it, I guess.
Well, first of all, you've begged the question because what evidence is there that he was doing the job? You know, he
tweeted an awful lot.
Yeah. He was being a pundit, right? I mean, people are going to use their ballpoint pens and just scratch right through the remnant bingo card thing. But he was a perfect illustration of the Yuval Levin stuff, right? I mean, where he used the institution as a platform for himself. And he preferred to be a commentator rather than, fulfilling the role that he was elected to. I think the answer to that, I mean, so there are two answers. One, I think, is obviously true, and the other might be true, but they don't contradict each other. The obviously true one is we know that, like, everybody who loses after a first term gets kind of bitter about it. George H.W. Bush, who handled it better than anybody, I think. I mean, you can make a case about Carter, but, you know, The Simpsons says he's history's greatest monster, and who am I to argue? There's some anecdotes about how he just told people, you know, the worst thing about it is it's just so damn embarrassing. And
yeah,
it's hard for us to imagine ourselves in that role and then getting fired for it by the American people. It's just got to be hard. And then you realize that the same solipsism that Trump has that allows him to think he didn't actually lose when he was in office, you can imagine how, like, I mean, like, this is a guy who craved television cameras. I mean, the old joke about how, like, the most dangerous place in Washington is between Phil Graham and a television camera pales in comparison to, like, how much Trump loved to be in front of a camera. And he's literally on a camera all the time. I mean, this is a point Rob Long made all the time, is that Trump woke up in the morning and had a makeup artist put makeup on him. He wore makeup all day long as president for 4 years. He loved that kind of attention. He loved moving markets. He loved riling Twitter. And he believed all the sycophants, because one of the problems that of his presidency was that he only listened to people who praised him. And so he had the capacity to believe that stuff. And so you could see how just not being able to compute the idea that he lost would work on his brain. And then there's this, that's not the cynical interpretation. That's the one I think is just indisputably true.
Yeah.
The cynical interpretation is, and I don't know if this is true, and I'm not going to invest a lot in it, but these criminal investigations, he may be like, look, the only way I can...
Yeah, I need to be president.
I need to be president. And the problem is I can't wait 4 years to be president. I got to be president now, or at least by August. Yeah. And that's a problem. I mean, that is a legitimate problem with criminally prosecuting former presidents, is they, if they're willing to be criminals in the first place, that means they might not have reluctance or forbearance to not do even worse things. To get power, hold on to power, and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's possible, you know.
Right. Well, so I saw on Twitter, I wish I could give this guy credit, because I think it was a pretty popular tweet. Someone said, why don't we just Truman Show it and tell him he's president, build an Oval Office, and just fake this world. I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. But also, what's the downside of that?
Right.
Like, why can't we just... Well, fake it.
You'd have to have some storyline about it being like a nuclear war or a much worse pandemic.
You have to give him something to do.
Well, no, but also you can't let him go outside to crowds and stuff, right? I mean, like, otherwise he'll figure it out. It's got to be something that can be contained on a soundstage. Right. So you can do like the VR helicopter kind of stuff, and it's moving around and feels real, but like, you can't have him go speak on the mall to a real audience, because someone in that crowd is going to say, you're a moron, this isn't real, and it's going to blow the whole thing, right?
I think
it's worth exploring.
I think there is an earnest belief in him, even though it is principally and almost wholly about for him just being the center of the universe. He does also believe that he is the greatest president. Well, I was going to say the greatest modern president or president in decades, but maybe the greatest president ever. Look at, and some of the things he did are fairly ephemeral. They've already been undone, but some of them aren't, like moving the embassy moving the embassy to Jerusalem, the judges. Look at what I did. I created the greatest economy, the biggest of all economies, the best of the biggest of all Americans, the greatest country, blah, 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 all that. And now he looks and says, look at what the Democrats are doing to it. They're destroying everything. We were entering another period of golden years. And part of that is just to rally up the Fox News and Newsmax base, but there also is, I think, some sincerity to it.
Oh, I'm sure there is. I mean, sure there is. I mean, like, people can convince themselves of all sorts of things, you know? and also, what helps enormously is Trump's utter ignorance about American history. So, like, you know, my favorite, which I mentioned on the podcast with Bushway Thursdays, you know, when he would say how blacks have never, ever, 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 ever had it this bad, saying this in 2016, which is just, not true. And Or my favorite was also when he would say in 2020, nobody has done more for blacks in America, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln.
The possible. I loved the possible.
That's my favorite locution,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. You know, exactly. Like,
I want to sound as if I'm being reasonable while I am pulling, you know, radioactive bald monkeys out my ass. So I'm going to say possible exception, right?
That makes I'll let the historians really figure out the details, but it's just possible.
Well, it's like the Sidney Powell thing at the same conference where Mike Flynn said he was going to that we needed a Burmese style coup. She also said that he should be reinstated, that he's going to be probably going to be reinstated. Yeah. And she said, unfortunately, the Constitution has no provision for restoring time lost. So, you know, he should get those extra 100 next days back, but he's just not going. And I love this because, first of all, there's also no provision for reinstalling a president, right? So, like, the idea that, like, this is your strict scrutiny kind of thing.
Problem. Yeah.
But it also, it's, I'm sure there's some rhetorical phrase in Latin or something about this technique of making a minor concession that makes it sound like you're telling hard truths to the audience. Right? So, like, she's like saying to the audience, I'm sorry to tell, I am so sorry to be the bearer of bad news. While he is going to be reinstalled as president, he's not going to get his full term that he deserves back because we have to stay loyal to the Constitution.
It's not brilliant. It's not Latin, and I think it's like a thing that people that study misinformation, they'd call it just a kernel of truth. Like, you just have a kernel of truth that hooks the people into thinking, hey, the whole thing might be true. As long as just a little bit of it's true, they just cling to that, and then it just gets worse and worse. Speaking of which,
yes,
UFOs.
Oh, yeah.
Kernels of truth. Little kernels of truth.
This is your obsession, right? This is like, this is why you're constantly making sculptures in your mashed potatoes that look like Devil's Tower, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm so fascinated by, we were so curious, like nobody knew anything about these UFOs or whatever they want to call them. And now they're just telling us. They're just telling us of everything about it, which is also what they're telling us is we have no idea what's going on. I just think it is fascinating that it was a secret for so long, and then they decided, oh, we might as well just reveal everything.
That's part of the most terrifying thing, right? So, like, work under the assumption that we're getting a lot more information that's not, you know, interestingly picked apart in a way to misdirect the public or something like that. It's the funny part about it is that the assumption, the kind of conspiracy theory assumption, always seems to be that the government is hiding stuff that they know about UFOs from us. But what if, like, the stuff that you hear Obama say now about it and stuff like that is actually the case, where it's essentially, so we have all of these pieces of footage of things in the sky moving really quickly. Mm-hmm. Also, we have absolutely no clue what they are. Isn't that infinitely more terrifying?
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
So for background for people, there's a report the Pentagon's going to put out by June 25th to Congress, and parts of it were leaked to the New York Times. And the headline of the New York Times, I love it. It's, U.S. finds no evidence of alien technology and flying objects, but can't rule it out either.
Right.
It's just perfect. Like, of course. I could have told you that.
So the headline I saw, which I guess was one of the articles that was bouncing around Twitter, said that government to say there's no evidence these UFOs are from outer space, or words to that effect. Mm-hmm. And on the one level, sure, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. But like the giant thing moving in ways that defies the laws of physics, without visible propulsion systems at weird right angles and all the rest. That seems like some evidence, right? I'm not saying it's dispositive, right? It's sort of, it's like, you know, like the bloody knife is not necessarily evidence that that Joe Blow murdered somebody.
Yeah.
But it's
we can't rule it out.
I'm not saying it's not evidence is the wrong word. It's not proof, right? There's a difference between evidence and proof.
Right.
People, it comes up all the time when Andy McCarthy used to make this point all the time about how he was sick of people saying, well, that's just circumstantial evidence. And he was like, every prosecutor will tell you circumstantial evidence is in fact evidence.
Right.
It's not, circumstantial evidence is not a coincidence. It's evidence. And it helps you say, well, okay, it's circumstantial that he happened to be in the bar at the moment the guy was killed. That doesn't mean he killed him, but because he was in the bar, it's evidence that it was possible. If he was 1,000 miles away, it would be evidence that it's not possible. And so like there's no proof that these things aren't from outer space, but the simple existence, it's like if a flying saucer now hovers over Washington, D.C., there's no proof it's from outer space if we don't have like tracking of it on radar coming from Alpha Centauri or something. But it's the mere presence of the giant flying saucer over Washington, D.C. is at least circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, exactly. That it comes from outer
space. I'm going to go with our audience here and push back. I mean, let's not be hasty. You know, can't rule anything out. But
yeah, be and to China, the point, I don't care where that thing came from. I'm still really worried about it.
Right.
Well, it's like my favorite line from Thoreau, and I was really bummed when I looked it up last year and found out there's an actual explanation for it, because I kind of liked it as sort of an auditory Dada painting. Was he had said some circumstantial evidence is very strong as when you find a trout in the milk. And I just liked it as a standalone statement without any context of understanding what he was saying, because it lets your mind wander about like
what it means.
Like, clearly the trout in the milk is evidence of something, right? And just let people figure out but it turns out that it was a fairly, well, not a common phrase, but it was a very common practice in the 18th and 19th century to cheat by watering down milk that you sold and claiming it was 100% milk, when in fact it was only, it's like watering down booze or putting, you know, baby powder in bags of cocaine or whatever, you know, stuff we all do. And so the context of it was, you should be pretty sure this milk is not 100% milk if it's got a trout swimming in it. And I much prefer the, I don't know what, just why he picked this succession of words, and it just conjures your own, you know, you get to fill in the blanks about the, what the trout in the milk is evidence for. But anyway.
Right. Yeah. Another reason not to drink skim milk, because you might find trout in your skim milk.
What is the Ron Burgundy, Ron Swanson line from Parks and Rec where he says, I'm gonna butcher
oh god
it, but he says, I don't drink skim milk because I hate liars, and skim milk is lying about being milk.
Right.
I was actually raised on skim milk, so I actually don't mind it, but
I had a lot of skim milk, but it turns out it's really not great for you, and like now with the low carb,
really.
Well, it's sugar water, basically. That's my understanding. And sometimes it's blue, which makes me very upset. I mean,
I would steer clear of that.
Well, you got to look at it in the right light. But yes, like, it has that weird kind of. I mean, I don't mean blue like RV toilet water.
Jonah, that's the trout water.
Well, that's like
the alien, you know, from The Last Jedi. Like
every 10 years or so, there's some story about people thinking that there's a meteorite going through their roof, and it turns out it was frozen toilet water from some plane. But that came down. I mean, I seriously, you Google it, you'll find
it. I believe that.
All right, so I had my wife made a point to me last night. I might write the G-file about it. I think it would be a good test of whether Hollywood has any testicular fortitude left. see whether or not they make a good, real movie about the outbreak of the COVID virus that treats the idea that it was a lab leak seriously. I mean, that could be a really good movie, actually, if you do, if get the right director for it. But Hollywood is so cravenly sycophantic to China. It's really unlikely that that will happen. But I mean, that would be, it would be a fun controversy. Like if Rupert still owned, does Rupert still own a movie studio? I don't think he does, right? They sold Fox.
Bezos Fox does. Stuff.
Bezos does, yeah. But I mean, he doesn't want to piss off China. I mean, how, you know, that's like, no. He's got issues.
Nobody
but like
does.
But it'd be a full employment act for Fox 24/7 about, you know, Hollywood censors movie about, you know, exposing lab leaks and, you know, and Trump's installation as president or whatever. You
that
know?
Really wouldn't be like the controversy around that movie would be just so many worlds colliding.
Yep. Great.
Yeah.
In the Hollywood version, it would probably leak out of Taiwan and John Cena will be the president who says we should have trusted China all along.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, you guys weren't, you know, you guys were embryos.
Fetal.
Yeah, whatever. When the first Red Dawn came out,
it was
central to a lot of our lives for a while. Yeah. That movie. And the remake of Red Dawn, where Hollywood actually went in and retroactively CGI'd it into the enemy being North Korea instead of China. The idea that North Korea could successfully invade North America, you know, the United States of America, and maybe Canada, but you know, like it's such a hate crime. I mean, the movie itself was bad, you know, because like, and since then, I mean, I don't think there has been a movie with a plausible, with a clear anti-Chinese bent to it of any kind since 7 Years in Tibet.
Well, when was the last when was the last vehemently patriotic movie you saw? Or that was exceedingly pro-American and was dripping in that kind of sentiment.
Independence
American
Day.
Sniper.
Oh, American Sniper is good.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
true.
The war movies.
Yeah,
Lone Survivor.
Yeah.
Those were good.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, I've written about this a bunch. Very difficult to make war movies with the Americans as the bad guys and have them be successful.
Yes,
it's very easy to make the movie. It's just very hard to make it a successful movie.
Right. Yeah.
And again, back when you guys were playing with crayons or whatever, the first 5-6 years of the Iraq War, Hollywood put out a string of these movies that were trying to talk about how bad America was or how bad the war was or all this kind of stuff. They did not do very well because people don't want to go watch.
Yeah, who wants to watch that?
Right. Wasn't there even, was there maybe an Oliver Stone one? That might be Slander, but I think the director for, the guy who directed Scarface, is that Oliver Stone? I can't remember now.
That's De Palma, right?
For Scarface, but he might actually had a writing credit on Scarface. I'm not sure.
Interesting.
Oliver Stone did write Scarface.
That's what I thought. Yeah, right. and he wrote Conan, which you know, the only reason why I'm czar, he's not going to the worst of the gulags. I don't know if he did a war movie during the War on Terror stuff. Maybe he did.
Yeah, I thought there was like a weird anti-American. Maybe it was that Nicolas Cage movie where he's an arms dealer in Africa. I can't remember now. There's something weird.
I mean,
like
look, but there was a Robert Redford one. There was Syriana with George Clooney, which, you know, like the part of the problem, and we don't need to go down a rabbit hole about how neoconservatism is misunderstood, the left in America in those days simultaneously wanted to say that neoconservatives were, warmongers. Some of them wanted to say that they were, you know, bagel snarfing warmongers, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And that America should be for democracy. And the problem is that the neocons, again, I don't like using the label. I don't like buying into this notion that that's what neocons are. We're for the most part talking about democracy and spreading right. democracy and building up democracy and all this kind of stuff. And so you had these very convoluted movies where you simultaneously had neocons being cast as like these perfidious string pullers behind the scenes, who were also somehow for subverting democracy when they, in fact they were wanting to do the opposite. And it right. got really complicated. And I cannot for the life of me tell you what Syriana was supposed to be about.
Interesting.
That was still, but at the same time, during the Iraq era, you know, Michael Moore goes on stage at the Oscars and starts castigating Bush, and the majority of the audience boos him, which yeah. is staggering to mm-hmm. think about with how the Oscars are yeah. today.
Yeah.
I forgot
yeah.
about right. that. Yeah.
Well, also just that people were watching the Oscars back then seems like
that's true.
right. Right. Speaking of this exact topic, do any of you follow on Twitter? I think it's just called George W. Bush era. Leftism bot, which
I've
is
seen
just,
it. I don't think I follow it.
It sounds amazing. Yes, it just posts. I mean, I don't think the person who runs the account is making them fresh. I'm pretty sure they have somehow combed through old blogs, old meme image boards, and stuff like that, and they're finding these early like W memes of him yeah. in like an infantry bulletproof vest and stuff like that. And it's got like Exxon Mobil on it. Mm-hmm. And it's got a speech bubble over his head. And he's got a cowboy hat photoshopped on it. It says like, I feel like such a badass right now. And if you remember that kind of like when we were in, you know, elementary school, that kind of attitude that a lot of sort of liberal people had, which was this sort of very populist, like get it, you know, he's dumb and he's and sort of conspiratorial. They're sort of conspiratorial memes of he's hanging out with Saddam and stuff mm-hmm. like this. And it's a weird wave of nostalgia in a way, but it's also helpful because it helps you remember that people have always been really nasty.
Oh,
I was going to say,
go ahead. Yeah.
No, just it reminds you that it might not be. I mean, it's bad right now, rhetoric wise, but it's also always been bad.
Yeah, and Americans are crazy, and they always have been, and that's kind of how we are. You know,
the The Village Voice had that cover with George W. Bush with vampire teeth biting into the neck of the Statue of Liberty.
he approved that, though.
I got to tell you, I went to the Democratic Convention. I went to the Democratic Convention in 2000 and 2004, and 96 and 92 and 88. Sure. But in 2004, it was amazeballs, to use a term from social science.
right.
In that a lot of the delegates were just truly losing their minds. And the Democrats had convinced themselves that nominating John Kerry would prove that they were actually super patriotic and and pro-military, just anti-war, and yeah, it got really crazy. And I remember being at the convention center or the stadium, wherever that thing was in Boston, on a tram thing full of like Michael Moore loving left wingers, and there's this lady standing next to me, and she's got this giant, keep in mind, at the time I think my wife was still John Ashcroft's speechwriter and chief policy advisor, and like the anti-Ashcroft stuff was all over the place. And anyway, there's this one lady wearing a giant button that just says, I do not, with the not underlined in red, consent to a search. And who's looking to search you, lady? I mean, like there's
okay.
There was an enormous amount of like weird paranoia, and that's why it's so funny for me to see people like Glenn Greenwald and Naomi Wolf and these people being picked up by Tucker as heroes, because back then they were considered the craziest of the left-wing crazies by right-wingers, right. by all yeah. of us. I mean, by everybody. And right. I mean, in fairness, Greenwald's a different creature than Naomi Wolf, because Naomi Wolf is nuts.
Yeah.
And I mean, just flat out nuts. And she used to like, report, you know, like literally she thought the SS was at her door, and like
right
all this crazy stuff. And yeah. But it was a crazy time back then. I mean, it really was. I mean, I had lots of death threats and all sorts of things back then for being pro war.
As opposed to now, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, at least back then the death threats came from the left.
I will say conventions do bring out the weirdest of sides.
Yeah.
Conventions are kind of like Twitter personified. Like Twitter might not be real life unless you're at a convention, political convention.
Yeah.
Because then you're like, oh, now I see everybody who's tweeting all these crazy things. They do exist and they're all here at the same time.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Michael Moore, Jonah? Have the two of you ever debated?
No.
Did you say dated?
Dated is a far more interesting question.
Well, no, it's only if it has a really interesting answer. And no, I don't think we've ever met. And so, I mean, just fun fact, which I don't, you know, I tend not to talk about all of the Lewinsky, Clinton, my mom stuff and all that kind of thing. But back during the height of that stuff, which also generated all sorts of fun death threats and whatnot. Michael Moore rented space in a building across the street from my apartment in New York City and set up a camera to spy on, and actually created a live cam thing on the web 24 hours a day to look into the window of our apartment to violate my mom's Fourth Amendment rights. This was his argument. This is not like my hyperbole.
Right.
His argument was, since my mom told Linda Tripp to tape recorder conversations with Monica Lewinsky, yada, 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 and Bill Clinton's, you know, privacy has been violated because whatever.
Wow.
We're going to do the same to you, lady. And so he set up this camera. It was a stunt, obviously. And the funny part about it was that this was, in fact, looking into my bedroom. And I mean, I didn't live there anymore, but like that's where I stayed when I came home and that kind of thing.
Right.
And and so I've had a personal dislike of Michael Moore for quite a while.
Yeah.
And in the 2000s, I was invited to a few campuses when there was protests over them inviting Michael Moore to speak. They would have me as sort of like proof that they were being even-handed kind of thing. And even though I did not like the implied comparison to Michael Moore, I didn't mind depositing the check and talking to the students. But I think one of the things to remember about Michael Moore is he's a horrible, horrible human being. And I mean that quite sincerely. He's just a bad dude.
You set up a camera, for God's sakes.
And not even that. I mean, that's just political theater. His, like, you know, he was an attention whore, and he, you know, that's why he thought OJ was innocent. You know, or he said he thought OJ was innocent because he liked getting the attention. But go back and you read, including pieces, I believe, in like Salon, about how he treated employees. Right? He makes these movies about, you know, the death of union towns and how labor is so important, and yet he was just vicious to his own employees for even hinting about unionizing and all these kinds of things. He is one of the most notorious do as I say, not as I do people. And he buys virtue on the cheap by pretending to be for stuff that he won't do in his own life. And so not a good guy.
And he did that. I can't remember, which movie it is, but he's in a, I think it was sort of a combination of a bunch of sort of left-wing tropes just all put together at once. In one of his movies, he, like,
you're gonna have to be more
my
specific.
Memory of it, I feel like this is,
you know, that's how he makes his living.
But there was one that was,
you remember that time Donald Trump exaggerated?
Well, listen, there's a point here somewhere, but I'm going to give it up because it's too muddled. I'm just going to give it up.
I mean, Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11.
I think it's Bowling for Columbine I'm thinking of, where he goes in to what my memory has in my memory banks as the New York Stock Exchange, but it's probably somewhere else, and starts ranting about how you can buy less Sudafed than you can buy bullets at a Walmart. And I don't think it's at the New York Stock Exchange, but in my memory, it's perfect because it's just sort of like every thing from George Bush era leftism all put together. It's like Wall Street and guns and the man, and I don't know. It's just amusing in my mind.
But Marilyn Manson when he was relevant and not canceled.
Right.
That dude's seriously canceled.
So, I mean, I know we're running along here, but have you guys, and but we just had like zero substance in this entire podcast. So, I mean, it's basically like eating a styrofoam cup. I mean, it won't kill you, but it just...
This has been profound, Jonah. This is what people
make
subscribe
Make them laugh,
for.
Make them laugh.
Yeah, you just got to keep in mind that like if the audience still hates this model is now dead. So
this is the apotheosis. Yeah.
Have you guys listened to the latest Hangover Starwalt podcast with Matt Continetti?
Yeah.
Yep. I got no nods out of Piss Boy, but that's okay.
yeah, of course I did.
Liar. I thought it was really interesting, but it made me think about it was Bush era leftism because there's also Bush era conservatism stuff, and I got my quibbles, but I think it's really. Was really useful to listen to. You know, one of the things that both Chris and Continetti, and I gotta say Steve, they're just so much better than I am at like saying, yeah, I think that was November 2007. Right. And for me, it's just time like, stamps. My rear view memory is much closer to two dimensional. It's like everything is just flat. And I can't remember whether something was like 2005 or 2015 or, whatever. Right. I mean, maybe it's because I'm drunk most of the time, but you know, but it was interesting. I had quibbles, but I think it was really, really good. I think one of the things that they didn't get enough into, well, I mean, I mean, you guys can correct me, but I think they barely talked about the Iraq War.
Right.
And and this idea that immigration was central to the rise of Trump and populism and nationalism and all this kind of stuff, which I agree with. And good for Continetti for writing about that early and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not trying to take anything away from Matt, big fan of Matt's, but I will say as a former National Review guy, this was an argument that National Review had been making for decades. And I'm much softer on immigration than a lot of my NR colleagues were, but the argument was always, if responsible politicians don't take immigration seriously, then irresponsible politicians will exploit it for their own ends. And that was an argument that NR pounded since the 90s. And I think it was right, you know, but it seems to me like there's just a big missing part of the conversation. Was about not just so much the role of the war, because the war went badly. You can look it up. the surge was even unpopular on the right back then. But the thing that's sort of interesting to me that I think a lot of people forget is how much the immigration stuff bled into the war stuff and vice versa. Insofar as, you know, if you read Jonathan Haidt, one of the reasons why immigration is like a big deal in our brains is this idea of contagion from others and outsiders coming in. And that's why like ideas of diseases from abroad freak people out. People forget how the Ebola thing was just off the charts panic, you know, under Obama. And it has to do with the fact, according to Haidt and others, is that a lot of our stuff about politics is right next to the part of our brain that's about hygiene. Moral hygiene, sanitation, all of these kinds of things. And so when we feel like something dirty or infectious or whatever is coming into our body politic, a terrible term, it triggers some of that stuff. And so anyway, the Iraq War, I mean, people forget, you know, like there was a huge conversation on the right, including with some friends of mine, about how we had to fight, we had to stand up right now, lest this country succumb to Sharia law. And like, I never understood it at the time. You know, yes, there were, I mean, I remember being driven around by a lady in Southern California for a speech to a group And Southern California has got some crazy ass conservatives in it. I just want to be clear about that. I mean, part of it has to do with David Horowitz having his little, you know, his little Republic of Horowitz out there and feeding people this stuff. Part of it has to do with the fact that it's the last vestige of that old sort of Goldwaterite thing. But it's also because it's just like really distant from actual politics. So it lends itself to, I mean, from Washington politics. So it lends itself to seeing politics through a literary prism rather than a like practical prism.
Harry Jaffa.
Yeah. I mean, I used to have problems with Harry Jaffa. I'll take Harry Jaffa any day compared, but it's like this, this feeling of powerlessness creates a permission structure that lets you invent all sorts of parades of horribles because you have no power to stop it anyway. So you might as well paint things in the most catastrophic way possible. Anyway, Southern California in wealthy right-wing politics is full of this stuff, which is why the Republican GOP, you know, sucks so bad. But I remember being driven around by this woman who was just saying how, yeah, they were, you know, her daughter really wanted to go to UCLA, but you know, it's, you know, any day now they're going to announce that it's going to be Sharia law compliant, and I won't send her there for it. And I was like, really? And she's like, oh yeah, no, it's totally, you know, it's like gateway pundit banana stuff. And anyway, and so like there was all of this stuff about fear of the dangerous internal enemy of Muslims and terrorists and sleeper cells, and you know, and some of it was completely understandable after 9/11, but it kind of went off the rails towards the end of the 90s, and it was deeply wrapped up in a lot of the immigration stuff in ways that people kind of forget. And and for me, the inflection point for all of it, which none of you guys probably remember, was the Dubai ports deal. You guys remember that? So the Dubai ports deal. Some Dubai company was going to buy a port, I think in Louisiana, and everybody freaked out. I mean, it was weird. It was like, and it was like left-wing socialists freaking out about it. Right-wing nationalists freaking out about it. Like, we're not going to hand over our precious bodily fluids to, you know, the Arabs and blah. I mean, it was crazy for about 15 minutes. And I remember writing one of the only columns saying, guys, calm the hell down. This is nuts. But, and so anyway, I'm not detracting anything from what those guys were talking about, but I would listen to it last night and it was really good. And, but I think immigration was a huge issue, but it was also emblematic of a whole other set of issues that were also in play. Anyway.
And that's still kind of here, right? Like you and I were talking yesterday about this Afghan interpreters situation, which is dire. And I was kind of like, why doesn't some GOP senator just jump on this bandwagon and be like, hey, let's get him back. I helped America, you know, rah, rah. And you said, well, some of their base is still genuinely afraid of bringing Sharia law, air quoting, like into the Americas. And I just hadn't really thought about that.
Yeah. I mean, it may not be like bringing the Sharia law in, but it's bringing, you know, like.
Sure.
You're going to get primaried the hell out of, you know, if some interpreter anywhere that you helped bring back ends up being a terrorist. And again, we don't want to import terrorists, but I ended up at your suggestion writing a column about it yesterday because I didn't have much time to write anything else. And I already like thought about it for the Dispatch pod and whatnot. But it just seems to me like there's testimony from these soldiers, these officers who say, you know, this guy killed three Taliban. He saved my life. He saved my platoon. Right. And I'll vouch for him and I'll put him in my house. It seems to me at that point, you don't need to vet the guy anymore. Right. I mean,
that's three more Taliban than any of us have killed. I mean, you know,
fact check. True. All right. So we're going to try actually keep this thing close to an hour because we have also have gotten some complaints about how long we've gone and the David French podcast from last week. From this week, was like 90 minutes. And some people were like, one guy literally wrote me, he says, Jonah, for the love of God, please try to stick to an hour because I want to hear the whole thing, but this is a huge commitment. I was like,
listen on 1.5 speed, people.
Exactly. It seemed fair. I mean, And then how long did our thing with Bushway go?
I think it was around 80 minutes. Yeah.
So folks, you know, folks who really love, for example, the homelessness podcast from a couple of years ago, where we just did a deep dive on a single policy issue. I really think you're going to like the Bushway thing. He was really good. And really nuanced and interesting. And I, you know, I learned some stuff. And, since we were talking about, I did want to ask you guys, did you guys like freak out a little bit when I talked about Morgan Reynolds becoming a 9/11 truther thing? Did that go over your heads?
I was just concerned about the 9/11 truther stuff.
Okay, yeah. So like,
it was very random. I was like, "Whoa!"
I know, but like, this is another part from this Bush era stuff, right? So like, Moore was a serious guy. I used to talk to him on the phone. I used a lot of his stuff from the NCPA, which is this big Texas think tank, and PhD economist. He was the chief economist in the Labor Department first 2 years of the Bush administration. And then he and like a bunch of these other kind of Reagan era, Reaganite guys became 9/11 truthers, you know, Building 7 was imploded and blah, all this kind of stuff. I mean, and just like, and this was like, so way before Trump, you know, we've had this conversation a million times about like, have some of these people always been like this and Trump just merely exposed it, or did Trump do something? Some of these people have just always, it's just been just below the surface. And it just takes something to pull it out. And, and I just remember being blown away when I found out that he was like, 9/11 was an inside job guy. And we can talk more about it next week, but we did a great podcast with Jonathan Rauch, which, you guys assure me is going to air next. We're going to be able to post next
week. Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
All right, guys. People, please, you know, in the comments, you know, or in the Remnant Twitter feed, you know, in or just, you know, you could leave a giant bag of cicadas on Ryan's doorstep, whatever. but let us know what you think about this. And I promise next week we'll go back to the solo thing. And we're also going to do some more of those sort of standalone eggheadery red things, because people seem to like those. And I think they keep, and they're probably good for the summertime too.
People
are on drives or gardening or, you know, trying to bury a body. So
that August recess is coming fast.
Exactly. And that is when congressmen bury the most of their victims. So
yes.
With that, thanks everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Hey, well, this is the podcast.